Hello everyone and welcome back to Family Forever Child's Conversations on Care podcast. My name is Amanda Griffith and I'm the CEO at Family Forever Child. This podcast is a space where we talk directly to practitioners about how they are providing care to vulnerable children and families around the world. At Family Forever Child, we're a network of 40 local civil society organisations working on the ground in 36 countries. And these organisations have a wealth of knowledge and experience from years of working with children and communities to develop solutions to improve children's care. This is our second podcast on the topic of care during COVID-19, which has seriously highlighted the gross inequalities that exist globally, not only between countries, but within countries. Even in well-resourced countries such as the UK, which will be our focus today, some families and children have experienced incredible hardships. Domestic violence is reported to have gone up significantly, and financial pressures have increased, and the ability to maintain education from a home environment has proved deeply challenging. For practitioners, this has been a difficult time. We have seen across our membership that all the organisations have adapted rapidly to the new context and transitioned into emergency response when needed. So far, here in the UK, has been one of the worst affected countries during the pandemic. As we record this in early September, there have been over 340,000 confirmed cases of coronavirus and over 41,000 deaths reported within 28 days of a positive test. The first case of COVID-19 in the UK was confirmed in late January 2020, but lockdown was not imposed until really late in March and eventually eased in May, where children are now returning to school. One of our member organisations based in the UK is the Mulberry Bush. They have a school which provides specialist residential therapeutic care, treatment and education for children aged 5 to 13 from across England and Wales, who are made vulnerable by their severe social, emotional and behavioural issues. I'm very pleased to be joined today by John Turberville, who is the CEO at the Mulberry Bush. Welcome, John, and thank you very much for joining us in this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. John, I wonder if you could give us some examples of the work you do and why you have a residential element to the work and you think that's so important to the support you give children.
Yeah, certainly. So the Mulberry Bush is a charity and it was really founded around a residential school in Stanlake in Oxfordshire. And from that, it has grown to offer other services. So an outreach service, which provides training and consultancy and also a space that has an extensive archive and the National Childcare Library that also runs events. But you're right, there's a residential element is absolutely vital to the school service that we run in Stanlake. And I suppose the importance of the residential element is that the children that we look after and the families we work with there do really struggle to learn to live alongside one another. So they struggle to live in groups, whether that's a family group, a school group, a community group. And so we really see our work as being putting those children in groups and working with the struggles that they have in groups. So the residential context really gives extensive opportunities for us to have our staff alongside those children in all the sort of challenging situations you find yourselves in a residential setting, really, the sort of familial type struggles that perhaps we all have been through in our time, but for the sorts of children that we look after, clearly those are exacerbated and are extremely difficult. It's probably important to say that the children that do come to the Mulberry Bush generally have struggled to function in sort of socially acceptable ways, if you like, in mainstream education or in special education, and so have faced multiple exclusions from schools, but also have really struggled to live at home with a family. So whether that's a foster family, an adoptive family, or their birth family. So really the work is in all areas of their life.
That's really helpful. Thank you, John, for giving us that example. And I think that really emphasises the need sometimes for residential to be part of how one provides a therapeutic intervention. Maybe we could move on a little bit now to look at about the context you found yourselves in at the beginning of the COVID crisis and about your experiences at Mulberry Bush during the pandemic.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, really right back at the beginning of March, before the guidance in the UK came out around how to best respond to COVID, we found ourselves in the situation where the children were at school. So I probably should have said that we have a 38-week service and a 52-week service. So we have some children who are there 52 weeks of the year, all year, and we have another larger group that go home for the school holidays or go to a home, and then we work with that home placement trying to support them back into a stable home. But we found ourselves at the beginning of March in a situation where we had a child who had some symptoms, some COVID-type symptoms. And through consultation with different professionals and then contact with Public Health England, there really wasn't at that point clear guidance from government about how we should respond. And we found ourselves hearing that we needed to send the large majority of the children home and the large majority of our staff home also. And that clearly was a real challenge to the whole school. But there were also a group of children who didn't have a home to return to, so they didn't have somewhere they could go. And that was both our six children who were our 52-week children, but there were also three others for whom there were real concerns about how they would be at home. So what happened was that we ended up with nine children on the site at school. All the other children went home, and we had a fantastic reaction from our staff team, and we had 14 staff who volunteered to live on the site at school for the period of self-isolation and not go home. So we were amazed and delighted, but perhaps not surprised, because staff are fantastic by that reaction. So we went through that process. I'm pleased to say that no other child showed any symptoms of COVID or staff member. And so following that, we went through the sort of process of bringing the children slowly back from home sort of through the Easter period.
So all of the children are now back in the residential setting?
Yes, really. They came back before Easter, the large majority. And we took the decision for them then not to be going home. So we've really reduced transitions for those children, which has been a real challenge for many of them. So yes, the decision was that they wouldn't then come and go from their home as they would normally do. And our staff then obviously had to work through the Easter break. And also our children usually go home every third or fourth weekend, or those who are on the 38-week program, really as a way of supporting the relationships with home and to really support the work that we're doing with the family and that child at home. So we also cancelled those weekends home. So it really left the children being at school for an extended period of time. When I say school, I mean the sort of whole thing of the households and the education area. Mm. So it was a really extended period of time for the staff and the children working alongside one another on the site.
And so what did you do in ways of maintaining contact with the family? Because as you say, this is a crucial part of the work you do, is rebuilding those bonds with family over time. So how did you manage to do that if you couldn't do home visits?
Yes, absolutely. It is absolutely vital. And it was really, I suppose, using all the medium available to us. So obviously phone calls, but also using all the sort of technology for face-to-face contact remotely, if you like, through laptops and tablets. So using things like FaceTime or Zoom or Teams and all those other apps that you can get. It doesn't compensate, I suppose, for the contact, but it in some ways helps to maintain the relationships and the interest. The other thing that we did, which was really interesting, was that we some staff members ran podcasts with some of the children, so in small groups, sort of posing various questions to discuss, which also included how they felt about COVID and what was going on. So that was quite interesting. And then we shared those for sort of further discussion. I should say, as the term went on through towards the end of the summer term, we absolutely recognised the importance of getting back in touch, those children seeing face-to-face their parents, carers. And so arrangements were made for that to be managed in a socially distanced way as we got into sort of May, June, July, and towards the end of the summer term.
Okay. And have you noticed, because for children, this idea of this invisible spectre and a sickness that is coming in and causing such disruptions to their schooling, to their home environment, to their day-to-day routines, how have you found that spectre of COVID-19, which is so difficult for children to visualize as this sickness that is out there that nobody quite knows how it even is transitioned to other people and things? So have you found that was something you had to build into your work as well, is enabling children to understand that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, obviously that they, in terms of their sort of contact with the wider world, it's absolutely everywhere, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's a very prominent spectre, as you call it. It's an interesting word to use. But what did happen when the children returned, rather than the usual format of working with four living groups on the site and the school, we actually split the children into three distinct separate groups, so they're like three small communities. The way that worked was that they had their own sort of physical area of the site. So they were multidisciplinary staff teams. So the children weren't going over to school. All education came into their household or their sort of their bubble area, if you like, to bubble. So we had actually two of those on our site, and the third bubble slept on the site. And then they travelled daily. They commuted, if you like, to we have another site in Gloucestershire, which is about 45 minutes away. And they commuted over there and had their education and sort of daily living experience over on our site at the Marlborough Third Space. So we were really lucky actually to have that in place. And I suppose that that experience of a very different model for the children in some ways emphasised, I suppose, this spectre, or the importance of having to understand this spectre of COVID that they were living within. I mean, what was, I think, really impressive was the children's ability to have some understanding about the importance of what was going on around them, and to not, I suppose, feel too angry with those in the immediate vicinity for the sort of new ways of living that they were having to endure, because it was a challenge for everyone, for the children and for the staff. You know, everybody was thrown into a different way of being. And I think things like the podcast and I suppose just ongoing conversations in the groups and groupings that they're in help them think and reflect on the impact that this new way of being alongside one another has on them all. And I suppose that's just central to the therapeutic community model that we run at the Marlborough Bush. Mm-hmm. About coming together in groups and groupings across the day to think about the sort of cause and effect or the impact of what's going on in everyday living, including the ways in which they were having to adapt to COVID-19.
So can I just pick up on a word you just used there and expand that slightly? Because you've spoken previously, I know, of how your staff are your main therapeutic tool. So what have you been able to put in place to support your staff, especially, as you say, those ones who stayed on and therefore haven't had contact with their own families and things and have really had to manage this shift in how the routines have happened for the children and things? What have been the actual effect for the staff themselves, and what have you had to put in place for them?
Yeah, in anything I say, I wouldn't wish to underestimate the impact that this past bit of time has had on our staff team. I think it has been enormous, and our staff are without doubt our most valuable and greatest resource. I think the first bit there, when those that self-isolated on site with the children for that period of time, we were quite concerned really about what the impact would be on the staff, what the experience would be like. And in the large part, actually, the staff really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. So I think there was something about the experience, the intensity or and the time that they had to be alongside one another and alongside the children to play and have just to enjoy one another's company, rather than the sort of highly structured, if you like, environment that we normally have on a day-to-day basis, going to and from school. And so there were, in some ways, it was a more relaxed environment. And so we were surprised by that, pleasantly surprised. I think since then, yeah, it's been really tough. The support structures that we have for staff generally continued, although many of those became virtual. So we for all of our staff, have spaces to reflect together, so reflective spaces where they come together to think with a facilitator about the impact of the work on them. So those continued, mostly virtually, which was different, but still, I think, of value. And the other meeting spaces that they are used to around sort of planning the children's care and the agenda meetings, they all continued virtually as well. I mean, I suppose we're lucky here in the UK that in terms of IT provision, we're well resourced. So we made great use of those facilities. I don't think we got it right for all staff. And certainly there was a real experience of moving from meeting structures and spaces where you can really look after one another. If somebody's upset or they found a particular piece of work challenging, or they're struggling personally, which many of us have done through COVID and lockdown, and the impact has been enormous on us all, both outside our working environment as well as inside. And I think that one of the difficulties in those spaces virtually is that if somebody does get upset or is particularly quiet, it's quite hard to look after them in the same way that one would do face to face, or even after a group when a group's finished. You know, it's much more difficult to go and make them a cup of tea or coffee, or say, look, you know, if you want to have a chat. Or so I think that sort of core part of the work has been more challenging virtually. I mean, the other thing that we did do, our outreach team and our training team did put a lot of our training on virtual platforms in the way that others have done. So we've tried to maintain access to our training and the additional information that helps maintain the sort of the high quality skill base that our staff team have. But it's tough, I think everybody is finding it tough, and in many ways we're no different to that. And we're all the time looking for ways of better supporting our staff team, ultimately, because if we don't get that right, it's hard to expect them to look after the children and their families. So, yes, it's been difficult.
Mm. Thank you. And that's a very thoughtful reflection, and interesting how, in some respects, some of it, the impact of it has been positive, as you say, because actually it's allowed for a slightly different way of interacting with the children. But actually then the supervision and support for staff has been more constrained. So it's interesting, there's two aspects that have happened through this process. Can I just explore with you something else that I know is very key to the way that Mulberry Bush works, and which is increasingly being developed in the sector, is this thinking about working in a trauma-informed way. And I know some practitioners actually speak about it in different ways. They say you can work in a trauma-aware way, or a trauma-informed way, or a trauma-capable way. I wonder what that all means to you at Mulberry Bush in terms of your ways of working, and what your reflections on that sort of terminology.
Yeah, sure. I suppose my understanding of those different terms are that they've really developed over time and in different countries, and are sort of brought together. And at the Mulberry Bush, I suppose we don't worry too much about differentiating those terms or understanding one as being different from another. What feels important is to recognise that trauma does have an impact on people and how you are. And particularly early life trauma has a sort of profound impact on social, emotional and development and physical and mental health as you get older. I suppose the children that come to the Mulberry Bush generally would fall into the sort of category of those with complex trauma. Trauma really revolves around the sort of interpersonal relationships for those children, and those things really affect their ability to build relationships, develop relationships, and relate to others. I suppose, and that can perhaps be differentiated a bit from some of the environmental traumas, in that if one is involved in some sort of environmental trauma, but you have sound and stable relationships with others around you, perhaps it's easier to navigate your way through it. Whereas when those things are absent and you're involved in some sort of other environmental or other trauma, and you don't have the support there available or the support of people to help you understand it, or you don't have the ability to develop relationships that may help you navigate your way through it, then it's far more difficult. So yes, at the Mulberry Bush, I suppose we accept that our children have complex traumas and multiple traumas. And I think the other thing that is important for us is that we don't sort of prejudge what the predominant trauma may be for a child. You know, the reality for us all over this last 6 months or so is that we are sort of immersed and surrounded by anxiety and confusion, uncertainty, and to an extent trauma. And the children are no different from that, but they also have other traumas going on, or have had them going on in their lives. So I think not prejudging what the predominant trauma for that individual child may be is just really, really important.
Thank you. So if I can now move on a little bit to think about the sort of what the immediate future looks like. So how are things now? Because obviously we have transitioned into out of lockdown, except in certain parts of the country. People are all seemingly returning to normal. However, the cases are going up and there's an anxiety about the winter. So I wondered how things are for you and what your immediate sort of thinking about how you're going to manage the next phase of this extraordinary pandemic.
Yeah. There's an enormous question. where we are now is that those children who are normally with us 38 weeks of the year did go home for a summer break, and which was really important because our staff also were able to have a break. So in some senses, there's a sort of back to normality element to where we are now. Our children... the 38-week children all returned last week to school, so they're all now back together with our 52-week children. So they're all back together on the site and working in the old model, if you like, so as they were before we split them into the three different bubbles. That means that our staff are also all back on the site. When I say all, I suppose what we have done... prior to COVID, we did have other staff on the school site in other roles. So the sort of support roles, if you like, you might sort of describe them as head office roles, if you like, sort of HR, finance, those sorts of things. But we also had some training staff down there. When I say down there, it's just down the road from me. That's why I say just down there. And what we've tried to do is to reduce all unnecessary footfall onto the site for this term. So it's just those staff who are working directly with the children or in direct delivery of the school service. So all other staff have been moved up to our office where I'm speaking from today, which is just up the road from the school. So in that way, I suppose lots of people refer to the new normal. I'm not sure whether it's a new normal or not. I don't really know what that is or what that sort of means. But so the school is back in some sense to the way they were working before, and that's been very challenging. I think we've found that many staff are in just different places in their how they feel about coming back to be alongside one another. And I think the other thing that's very difficult for us at the moment is that as a residential therapeutic school, we sort of fall between the advice and guidance to schools. Which is basically saying, look, you're back to normal in the UK. Generally, no PPE. Children not socially distancing, but staff socially distancing from children and young people. And social care, which generally is saying, yes, PPE. People should be wearing PPE. And so we sort of fall between the two. So where we're at is that our staff, and it was the same beforehand in the bubbles, that they aren't generally wearing PPE, or they aren't wearing PPE. And we've accepted that our children are really not able to socially distance. So they've been very much living as sort of large family bubbles, if you like, when they were in their three bubbles and now in their living units, and they are going over to school. But where that leaves us in terms of guidance is in a slightly unclear situation. So really having to work on the hoof with issues that come up. So we have had two staff members who reported that they had been in touch with other people who had then been tested positive for COVID. And so we've been having to make decisions about how we sort of manage those situations as they come up in conjunction with England and so on. So that's where we are in relation to the school. The other services which do, you know, directly relate to that in terms of reaching out to mainstream schools are returning back to normal. So we're back in the offices on a sort of rota basis, again, to reduce the numbers. Others are working from home at certain days of the week, but really trying to offer as much support as we can to schools and social care as children return, because many will find it very difficult and many have been traumatised by the situation that they have been and remain in. So we're looking to reach out in a whole variety of ways, both virtually and face-to-face.
And in terms of the sort of wider groups, have you found that you've collaborated with other partners through this time? Because you are quite a really specialist service. So have you found that you're doing something in quite a unique way, or have you been able to sort of reach out to others and form sort of ways of collaborating and thinking about how to work with this new context?
Yes, I mean, I think if I'm honest, I think in the early part of COVID, we were perhaps no different from many others in sort of fire. It felt like firefighting, reacting to what was going on within, and trying to make, you know, the best job of a very difficult situation. But as time has gone on, yes, we have been really looking to collaborate with others. Initially, we set up something we just called the Think Tank, which is a sort of multi-professional group. It's a virtual group. So it's sort of heads of various of the national services and linking into government departments. So we have about 15 or so people on that group, and we ask people to come together to really help us think about where we were as a charity in our work, but also how we could better partner and collaborate with others, but also how we could better support other services and those of members of the think tank. And that's been a really interesting and valuable process. It started off very much as, I suppose, what it says on the tin, a sort of a task-focused think tank, and has moved into a group that divides its time between that task-focused work and a reflective space. So a space to reflect together on what's going on for individuals in the group, their organisations, and in the wider world. I suppose as a way of informing the work. And that's been particularly valuable. We, as part of an initiative in that, we also showed a film about adverse childhood experiences, resilience, and that was really good. We did that a couple of weeks ago, and we had about 300 people online watching the film with us, and then we had a discussion forum. We had about 90 in the discussion forum. And that was very, very interesting. A very broad group of individuals, professionals, practitioners, and people who've been experienced in residential care and social care. And that was a very thought-provoking group. And what's sort of emerging from that potentially is having some sort of regional reflective groups for practitioners and organisations or members of organisations to help them think about the impact of the current situation on them and their organisations and practice. And so we're just looking at how that might develop, but we certainly at the moment got about 20 or 25 people who are interested in that. And another thing that sort of emerged in the last few weeks has been working with some of the charities in Oxfordshire and the local authority who try and support those involved in domestic abuse and domestic violence. So we've been looking to collaborate with them and have actually achieved a funding grant which will help us establish a group or a number of days over the coming 6 months over at our new site over the Marlborough Third Space. So we hope to be able to provide an experience over there which we can be a sort of haven and reflective breathing space, if you like, for those families that are really in the thick of struggling with issues around domestic abuse and domestic violence, which, as you know, is very clear in the press, has grown enormously through this last period with this, you know, intensely people being locked down together, if you like. So I think that's been good. And it's just very clear from all the conversations we're having that it is about reaching out and collaborating and partner, you know, looking for partnerships and encouraging others to do the same.
That's fascinating examples. And as you say, this sort of, which is interesting because it sounds like you've actually transitioned to working with whole families too in this new initiative rather than the specific focus on children and then the family, is it?
Yes, I mean, I think for about 10 years at the school, I suppose we very much focused on the idea that the child who's placed with us, you know, that it's not really fair for them to carry a sort of disproportionate burden of responsibility for dealing with all the issues going on in their family, and somehow we need to engage the family in that work. So school, they certainly have increasingly been working with the family, both face-to-face, virtually. We've been doing couples work, family therapy work, multi-family therapy groups, groups for foster carers, group for adoptive families, group for birth families. So we've really been looking to develop that work, and we have a team at the school who do that work for those children who are placed. And I suppose this is about finding a way of taking that out into the community and communities around us to try and support and help where we can. But yeah, absolutely, families is just so important.
So in terms of that think tank and that experience, do you have anything that's really come through that you think would be really valuable to share with other practitioners at this moment in time, in terms of thinking of your reflections over this whole experience and where you're now moving into, and you sort of think, well, these are some key thoughts to share?
I suppose mine are quite broad at the moment, so perhaps not particularly detailed. I mean, going back to what I said before, I think what's come from that think tank, is acknowledging the reality that we're going to be in this situation for some time to come. That in terms of trauma and mental health, the needs are going to be greater than they ever have been. But in terms of the finance available and the financial support available to deal with them, it's going to be probably less than it ever has been. So, that's a real challenge. And generally, the view from the group, which I think is probably fair, is what that means is that we are going to need to not sit behind our doors and expect people to come to us, but we need to get out there and get into communities, sort of to get in and alongside those who need the support and help that we have to offer. I suppose the other thing, that the last think tank that has really made me think about the current situation, is going back to this sort of phrase, the new normal, or I suppose adapting the ways we work for the current situation. Was a lot of people were saying, well, but perhaps we should be considering that this is permanent. And many of these changes are actually permanent. And I think that's really challenging in terms of thinking, so what does that really then mean for the future of our services and the ways in which we are looking to look after and support those in our communities that are struggling? And so this whole idea of, so are we just going to be, you know, working like this for, I don't know, is it 6 months, is it 8 months, or until there's a vaccine, or, you know, all these other things that are in the media, you know, if it's permanent, what does that mean? What does that mean for us? And so I think, you know, that feels really important. The other thing that's been acknowledged through the think tank, and I suppose is very much a part of our culture here, is that it's very easy to sort of try to sort of jump to conclusions and to action, a sort of call to action, but to ensure people really take the time to stop and to think and to reflect on what's going on for them, what's going on for their own families and in their own life, but also then, of course, how that then influences or affects those that they are looking to look after. I suppose what it is worrying is the longer this goes on, the sort of risk of burnout for many people who work with those who are struggling, whether it's in the NHS or in social care or in education, is a real risk. You know, how long can people carry on, you know, giving 110%, 120%? I think that is a real worry. So I think the importance of being able to stop and think and reflect together on the impact of the work on oneself in a group and to allow groups to support one another with that, I think is really important. And within that context, I suppose just acknowledging something I said earlier, which is this sort of uncertainty, the anxiety and the trauma is just, it's everywhere. It's all around us, not just in this country, it's global. And that's really difficult and worrying, but it does need to be voiced and acknowledged because it's very real. And I suppose that's the context within which we are all working. And if we don't acknowledge that, I suppose the risk is that you know, if we don't sort of bring it to consciousness, then it can just become overwhelming and overbearing on certain individuals, perhaps who take too much responsibility for it, or who are you know, carry that role of doing the worrying on behalf of everybody else, or you know, carrying that burden. So I just think that is really important. So those are the main things. I know they're very sort of big and global, perhaps not particularly detailed, but that's where I'm at the moment, certainly. And that's what I am talking to the practitioners here about is those things.
John, thank you. This has been a fascinating podcast, I must say. And what I've drawn from this is the environment in which you always work, which is one about anxiety, about difficult relationships, about the complexity of being in a group, and about sort of resilience, is actually, and mental health being so incredibly important. In many respects, what you're reflecting is we've now joined that circle in a certain way, is it's now become part of so many more people's reality to a certain degree, is exactly those things that has been the sort of core of what Mulberry Bush is seeking to work on in an incredibly therapeutic way. So thank you, because I think us reflecting on what does a therapeutic approach mean is helpful for all of us to think about, but that is our context, and this is something that we need to be acutely aware of. And as you say, the importance of that is really ensuring that you provide spaces for reflection, so we're not, because the danger is we're all in massive doom mode because we are dealing with something that is very immediate, and if you're into something that seems very urgent and needs a response quite quickly, the danger is you don't take the time to step back and reflect on what does this mean, not only for the children we're serving, for my staff, but for myself. And that I think is really probably the key thing that you've helped me to think about in this podcast. So thank you for that. Thank you to your staff too for doing such an incredible work. Always, I'm always so impressed with the work with Mulberry Bush, but particularly for those that have stayed with the children during this period of time, is really inspiring. Thank you so much for sharing your insights on what you've been doing. And I'll now just bring this podcast to a close. Thank you again. And thank you to those of you joining us to listen to this conversation on care. We hope you will join us next time, and be sure to sign up to receive alerts of our new podcasts and other activities via the How We Care website at www.howwecare.community. Thank you very much, John. Good to speak.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.